So yeah, thanks very much, Matt. Thanks to the organisers for this very stimulating and slightly and nicely cross-disciplinary Quantum Foundations conference, and for giving me a chance to speak. Like Matt, I have to sort of slightly apologise in that I was asked maybe 3 weeks ago or so, and I hoped, as one does, I hope to finish more arguments than I managed in 3 weeks. But I want anyway to talk about the idea of combining classical gravity with quantum theory, what might go wrong and what doesn't go wrong, and some arguments for its impossibility that I think should never have been taken seriously and certainly should be disposed of now. So some of the work I'm going to talk about is quite old, and I apologize to the people who know it, but I think it's mostly not that familiar to a lot of people, even in the Foundations community. And some of it's more recent. I should say I'm interested in the possibility of combining classical gravity with quantum matter, not out of any strong prejudice. There are lots of good aesthetic reasons for trying to quantize gravity, and I don't have arguments against that. I just want to understand what we know about the alternative possibility and to what extent, if at all, there are no-go theorems. So I'm going to start by talking about an argument that I'll go through that's now quite ancient, but still surprisingly influential, the Eplia-Hanna argument, which claims to be a no-go theorem that forces you to the conclusion that you should quantize gravity. I'm going to talk about a simple model that does something like the same sort of thing that PR boxes do. It gives you a way of extending quantum theory by hypothetical devices. I'm going to explain why that model is consistent despite first appearances, and why, among other things, it refutes the Eplia-Hanna argument. And then I'm going to talk about other things that follow from that set of ideas, including I'm going to touch on a recent space-based experiment proposal and the so-called collapse locality loophole. So we've heard about loophole-free Berlin equalities. The experiments are beautiful and they're very significant, but the definitiveness was overstated, I'll explain. So I'm going to talk a little more about that, about this loophole that remains open and how it could be closed, about something very weird that is motivated by these ideas, a very strange alternative to quantum theory, which to my mind is just an interesting challenge as to how well, so I'm pretty sure it's wrong, but how do we know it's wrong? Or how can we come to be confident that it's wrong? It's a challenge to our understanding of physics. And if I have time, see how it goes. I'll explore some more tentative thoughts about semi-classical gravity in the Page-Galka experiment. And another thing that I've been thinking about for a while, testing the Bell non-locality of the gravitational field direct. Okay. So we still have quantum theory going strong. We still have GR going strong. We still don't know how to combine them. As we all know, quantum theory is linear, and that's part of its beauty. It's probabilistic in appearance, maybe in fact. Depends exactly what view you take about many worlds. It violates Bell local causality. We don't really know what relativistic quantum theory is in a mathematically rigorous sense, although there are many successes of gravity. On the other hand, GR is also beautiful. It's nonlinear, and that's part of its beauty. It's deterministic, not probabilistic. It respects Bell local causality because it doesn't really have any choice because it's deterministic and it's local. Singularities, among other things, suggest that GR itself can't, even if we didn't have quantum theory, can't quite be a complete theory. So a line of thought that keeps coming up from time to time is, do we have to destroy one of these theories, destroy as in the sense of get rid of all of its defining principles, in order to unify it with the other? And if not, then you're looking at some sort of hybrid theory which has elements of both and respect some of the principles of both. And the standard thing, if you follow this line of thought at all, is to think about a hybrid of classical gravity and quantum matter. So I want to look at arguments against that. And also arguments, so there's this general tension between the non-linearity of GR and the linearity of quantum mechanics, and trying to unify them in anything other than quantizing gravity tends to encourage you, at least, to think about non-linearity that infiltrates from GR, from gravitational modes, into quantum theory. And then there are standard arguments to say that that's not just an anesthetic thing, but it's an inconsistent thing, either because it gives you a theory that's not well-defined, or because it allows superluminal signaling. So I want to look at those arguments as well. And I want to refute both of those using the model that I'm going to come to. So, okay, well, there are three recent papers that I'm going to touch on of mine, and then three much older ones. The paper I'm going to start critiquing is ancient now, Hepby and Hannah. I'm not going to say very much about them because I don't have time, but there have been previous criticisms and significant criticisms of Hepby and Hannah, but in a different direction and in a more tentative direction. So Hepby and Hannah propose a thought experiment. James Mattingly argued that thought experiment just isn't feasible given the parameters of our universe. You couldn't actually carry it out in practice. Huggin and Callender pointed out correctly that the arguments are based on some particular interpretations of quantum theory and don't run so well or so obviously in others. Albers et al. Looked at a one plus one dimensional quantum gravity theory and ran through a rather complicated perturbative calculation and concluded they didn't quite believe the argument in that context. But I don't. One of the things that baffles me is their conclusion is that their classical degrees of freedom become entangled with the quantum degrees of freedom, and this gets around the argument. And I don't understand what it means to have an entanglable classical degree of freedom. So anyway, people should certainly look into these arguments themselves, but I'm not going to say much more about them here. And then for the gravity experiments, there's the famous Page-Gallagher experiment that I might be able to touch on. There's this very recent proposal for space-based tests of non-standard ideas of quantum theory plus gravity. And there's a 10-year-old experiment testing the one experiment that's tried to look at collapsed locality loop. So what did Hepby and Hannah claim? Well, they claim that gravity must be quantized. It's still... Here's my take on this. It's a sort of zombie argument. I mean, there's no life in it, but it frightens people. It's they sort of, and if they're not careful, it actually eats away at their brains and makes them persuaded that really there is something to it, and you just have to quantize gravity, and maybe you do for lots of other reasons, but not for this reason. So. As far as I'm aware, there just is no solid no-go argument against hybrid theories. It's a matter of scientific taste, of what seems most fruitful, and in the end, what seems empirically successful, whether gravity is quantum. So I said it's influential. If you look at Steve Weinstein and Dean Rickles' Quantum Gravity, which was even the most recent edition, their article in the Stanford Encyclopedia, it summarizes without really disputing it, the conclusions of the Hepby and Hannah paper. I'm a big fan of Sabina's blog, but on Hepby and Hannah, I guess I just disagree with her. So this is a few years old, but I don't think she's updated it. She reviewed the Hepby Hannah thought experiment, and words speak for themselves. Maybe not the best motivation one can have, but it's a lean way to illuminate. Even while I was browsing the internet, Tyler Cowen's blog I read often, and the other week there was a link to a another attempt at an explanation of why quantum gravity is definitely needed. So, okay, somebody is wrong on the internet, shock, horror, but it goes beyond it goes beyond that. The argument is it's still out there and it still influences people. So here's the abstract. And here is the basic idea. Their thought is that if you have classical gravitational degrees of freedom, then you can make probes with arbitrarily low energy, but also arbitrary low wavelength of gravitational waves. You can fire them at quantum matter, and something has to. They then give you a trilemma. Something will break down as a result of this. So they run various hypotheses past you. One of them is that you do this, and it acts as a standard sort of measurement, and it collapses the wave function. So you can look at the scattered gravitational wave, and you can work out how well localized the particle is from doing that. And you remember, you're doing this with a wave of arbitrary low energy, so you get arbitrary low momentum transfer. So they argue you violate the uncertainty principle. You can localize the particle arbitrarily well while not affecting the uncertainty in its momentum. There are many problems, but this isn't the one I want to focus on. So let's run with their alternative line of thought. Their alternative line of thought is when you fire a gravitational wave at quantum matter, it doesn't collapse the wave function. And then they say this leads to superluminal signal. So the argument is you make an entangled pair in the standard sort of way. In this case, they're entangled in position space so that you get combination of, let's say, the photon either going along this beam after going through the Causant, I'm entangled with this one going this way, or this going this way, and this going this way. And over here, somebody can measure the state. So if it doesn't collapse the wave function, but you still get information about the localization of the wave function, they say, well, if there was a genuine measurement carried out over here, then the photon will be either in this beam or this beam. And when you probe it with gravitational waves, you'll find out, aha, it's in this beam, no photon here. So you learn instantaneously that somebody's carried out a measurement. And if they don't carry out a measurement, then, what they actually say, embarrassingly, is that it's in a superposition of these two things. And so you learn that there's some localization here, some localization here, and that they haven't carried out measurement over here. Okay, so just to break off for a moment from Epley and Hannah, I promised to say something about nonlinearities, and I'm going to use the same model to discuss both what's wrong with Epley and Hannah and why nonlinearities aren't necessarily a disaster. Maybe other good reasons for rejecting them, but they don't lead to contradiction. So I just wanted to give one simple example of how nonlinearities might get into the game when you're trying to combine classical gravity and quantum matter. And this is the Schrödinger-Newton equation. So if you look at this, this is supposed to be an equation for center of mass wave function of an object with wave function psi, h body psi v dt. Good, this is all Schrödinger, this is all Schrödinger. But we have another potential here, phi, and that's the classical gravitational potential generated by this self-same object. So phi behaves as though it's sourced by, in this equation, it behaves as though it's sourced by a mass distribution corresponding to mod psi squared. And so if you put these into a single equation, you see that there's a nonlinearity in psi. This term here depends on mod psi squared as well as on psi. So one reason why people think about this equation is as an attempt to extract a Newtonian limit from semi-classical gravity. If I have time, I'll say more about semi-classical gravity. I'm not going to say more about Schrödinger Newton. I just wanted, it's perhaps the simplest explanation for people who haven't thought about this as to why you end up worrying about non-linearities when you try and combine classical. All right. So I promised a model. Here it is. And maybe I'll expand a little on it on the blackboard. So as with Popescu and Rehrlich, though differently, we're going to imagine, hypothetically, that standard quantum theory, and in particular relativistic quantum theory, is supplemented by little hypothetical black boxes. And I'm going to say things loosely and then try and see what precisely we should be saying. So loosely speaking, what the black boxes do is this. You input a quantum state into them, and they don't disturb the state. They output the same state, but they also give you a classical description. So this thing's been tuned to expect some Hilbert space, and it prints out psi in the basis you told me in this Hilbert space is, and it lists the complex coefficients on the basis elements like so. Well, what one should worry about this. What does the black box do? It certainly allows you to clone psi, because if you put psi in and you get psi out, but you've also got a classical description of psi, you can make as many copies as you like. Another thing it allows you to do is to create a nonlinear evolution of psi. Since you could put psi in, read out psi, and then apply some sort of external field of your own choice that depends on psi, so that now psi is evolving under a Hamiltonian that itself depends on psi. Those are generally things that are generally frowned upon, even in hypothetical models. These are things that should concern us. So let's elaborate on the concerns before we elaborate on why we can get around them. Well, on the one hand, GR is nonlinear, so maybe the reasons I mentioned, we should be okay with thinking about models with nonlinear quantum evolution. At least we have some motivation. And if there is a nonlinear version of quantum theory, maybe cloning is possible. So we have to sort of sharpen our worries. They're going to be two serious worries. Either this model allows superluminal signaling, in which case it's certainly not a good combination with relativistic quantum theory, or it's just logically inconsistent. It isn't actually well-defined. So indeed, both cloning and nonlinearity are often said to imply superluminal signaling, and there's an important sense in which they do. But we do need to be careful about our assumptions. So the standard, sort of crude version of the standard argument as to why cloning, for instance, allows superluminal signaling is take an entangled state. Let me leave that for the moment. Here's B, they're sharing that state psi. If A measures in the 0, 1 basis, then that will leave B with a mixture of 0 and 1. If A measures in plus or minus, then B has that mixture. If B has a cloning device, they can run whatever's in their hands through it, and they'll end up with a mixture of 0, 0, 1, 1, or plus, plus, with minus, minus. And while the original mixtures, of course, weren't distinguishable, these mixtures after cloning are distinguishable, so B can tell which measurement A carried out, and therefore A has superluminally signaled to B. That's the sort of standard line of thought. So indeed, if it's the case that carrying out a measurement here instantaneously has the effect of creating a state here, in a not just in a mathematical sense, but in a physically meaningful sense, in which, because this thing can be cloned and these things can be distinguished, then you would have superluminal signaling. But notice that's just a senseless thing to suppose in the first place in a relativistic theory. If we have a model in which the effect of a measurement has an observable physical effect, it makes no sense to say the effect of that measurement is instantaneous and everywhere, because instantaneity, of course, is frame dependent. So our first problem wasn't that we have superluminal signaling, it's that we uttered sentences that don't really mean anything in a relativistic context. What could mean something, though, if we assume that carrying out the measurement has some objective physical effect that's readable elsewhere, is to allow those physical effects to propagate at light speed. So going back to our readout devices, if what they actually read out is what I call the local quantum state, in other words, if you have a wave function on a hypersurface like this, a space like one through a point P, well, think of a limit as these hypersurfaces get closer and closer to the past light cone. For each of the hypersurfaces, you could trace out degrees of freedom everywhere except at P, and you can get a density matrix. And you could take the limit as these things get close to the past light cone, call that thing rho P, the local quantum state. If what your black box is doing when you put a physical system into it is reading out the local quantum state, then this argument that you have superluminal signaling does not work, and that, well, we still have to worry about whether there's an internal consistency in the model, but we certainly don't have any superluminality. So just to, it's probably better to spell this out on the board, just to think about, again, the simple case of a singlet. What exactly are we postulating out of our black boxes here? T equals minus infinity, Alice and Bob prepare a singlet and share it, and they separate. There's no Hamiltonians, so the evolution is just trivial. Still a singlet. At T equals zero, let's say Alice over here measures in the 0-1 basis, and let's say she gets outcome zero. Well, if T equals zero, or even a bit later, if Bob puts the state into his black box, he will get out just the uniformly mixed state of times theta 2. That's local quantum state. That's what you get if you apply the prescription I gave you on the previous slide. And that keeps on being true until this point, when the readout device behaves differently. And now if Bob puts his system in, he gets the answer 1. I don't just mean the state 1. He actually gets a printout telling him that he's got the state 1. OK. Are people happy enough with that so far as a hypothesis? Any?
Can I try to test it?
Sure. If you have a black box, you can. You want me to say more about why I'm introducing this? Yeah, I'm going to, but.
This kind of effect also look kind of. Then I have a measuring device and I will make large ensemble and to test this strange claim which you make. And this claim itself maybe can be arranged so you can, I don't know.
So the idea is we see whether we, unknown to us, we actually have some measuring devices that behave like these black boxes. Is that the idea?
So you say that this is not signaling. This is,
right. Yeah.
This is also kind of.
Okay, maybe we should discuss afterwards.
Okay. What?
Yeah.
I understood what you said on the board, but what was the significance of the set of space-like surfaces that converge to the backward light cone? I didn't quite see how that.
You don't just want a description for a simple bipartite system. You want a general prescription for a state that could have a continuous wave function in space. So the what I said here follows from this general prescription. So assuming that these are point-like particles in this simple example.
So this is meant to answer the question of how would you do this not for two discrete systems, but a continuous system?
Yeah.
Okay, so
it would have to give you a density rather than a...
Why do I need this family of surfaces?
Because the wave function isn't defined on the past light cone itself, or at least except as a limit. So in relativistic quantum theory, we have prescriptions for defining wave functions of space like hyper surfaces. Yeah, so they're not, I think it sort of fits with most people's standard intuitions about relativistic theory, but I just wanted to be careful. Okay, so no superluminal signaling, but is it consistent? Well, device at any given point is only going to produce information, I claim, that you could actually calculate if you knew three things. Now, sadly, we don't, but if you did, you could replicate the device. So the first thing is knowledge of the initial state the initial state of the universe, or at least the initial state on the intersection of a hypersurface in your past light or a B. Second is precise knowledge of the unitary evolution law. And the third is knowledge of any and every collapse or measurement event that took place in the past light cone. So for C, let's notice you need, and I'm not going to commit to any particular thing, but you need some sort of model of localized collapses measurements. So the fact is, we may never know. We may never have knowledge of A. We may never have knowledge of C. We're struggling even to get complete knowledge of B, so who knows? Maybe we'll never get any of them. But there's no logical inconsistency in a universe in which locally based agents have all this information, even if it's given to them by some hypothetical deity, and use it. But if there's no logical inconsistency in that, well, any agents who have all that information can calculate at every point what the black box would actually give as a readout. And so they can effectively simulate the action of the black box. They can simulate the action of these extended versions of quantum theory that have state readout devices. So this isn't to say you should believe in the readout devices, but it is to say we've got a simulation argument that establishes that not only is there no superluminal signaling, but also there's no logical inconsistency in supplementing quantum theory with these devices. And going back to Epley and Hanna, well, we've already touched on the fundamental problem. They're trying to talk about relativistic interactions between classical and quantum systems, and they assume that the effect of a measurement one place instantaneously has not just a mathematical effect, but a physically observable effect at another place, a physically observable effect because you can probe it with gravitational waves. That makes no sense in a relativistic theory. Whatever you're going to postulate, you can't postulate that. Instantaneous frame dependent. On the other hand, if you want to talk about objective collapses, and they did, and you want classical gravitational degrees of freedom to interact with something that depends on the quantum state, we've got a natural candidate, the local quantum state I just introduced. So if we assume that, then you can hypothesize what you like about this unknown theory, but in particular, you can allow your gravitational wave probe to get information about the local quantum state, and maybe even if you probe it well enough to at least approximate a full quantum state readout device, maybe you can get all the information about the local quantum state. Well, at the level of discussion that Epley and Hanna were running, that's a a classical quantum hybrid model. We're not trying to give all the dynamical details, we're just talking about the principle here. It has no superluminality, and so Epley and Hanna argument fails. Okay. So people have recently become interested in testing non-standard intuitions about the combination of gravity and quantum theory that use this idea. So in particular, there's a paper by the Space Quest team who are interested in some intuitions that derive from Tim Ralph and Gerald Milburn and collaborators Downs and Pienaar. I'm not the right person to talk about those particular intuitions and how well motivated they are. I've tried to think about them, but I'm slow, and they rely on thinking about what you would expect from a theory with closed time-like curves, and there's a lot of literature on that. But I just want to first list all the people involved in the proposal, all these good people, and then just spell out the relevant bits for this discussion of their proposal. So based on their intuitions that because a good theory of combining quantum theory and gravity should be consistent in theories in which there are closed time-like curves, their intuition is that you get if you prepare an entangled state and they go through different gravitational potentials along their paths, you get an extra intrinsic decoherence when you measure the two. And it's a nonlinear effect. So this is the first figure from their paper. Here's the input state and the output state. And to model what they think should actually happen, you can model it, but you need a second copy of the input state. So effectively, you need a cloning device to sort of draw a diagram as to what happens. And the output state depends on an action, something that is both nonlinear and involve two copies of the input state. And their prediction is that that this makes most sense. You can handle the nonlinearities appropriately on the sort of hypotheses I discussed. So defining what you mean by a nonlinear theory is effectively modeled by these sort of readout devices. And if one photon is measured over here in space and another one stays on the ground, then it could be measured either at A, which is time-like separated from C, or at B, which is space-like separated. Their intuition, or at least what they want to test, is that you see a difference. You see extra decoherence in this second case compared to the first case, even though the thing is just being stored. So one has to form one's own views about how strongly motivated the intuition are. But it's at least pleasing to see that people are willing to go out and test some non-standard ideas combining quantum theory and gravity, which are amenable to test and which involve non-linearities and therefore need some prescription handling the non-linearities. Okay, so you also, of course, need a localized collapse hypothesis. And again, as they discuss in paper, it's rather hard to define their model unless they have a localized collapse. It's the many worlds version. Suffers from a generic problem of nonlinear theories that it's not really clear how you can prepare a state in the first place or how separable systems, the evolution of separated systems can be consistently modeled. So if you have localized collapse hypotheses, you have motivation for other experiments, and this takes me on to the loophole freedness or otherwise of Bell experiments. They've been widely and rightly celebrated so-called loophole-free Bell experiments. But there's still a, to my mind at least, a significant loophole that we want to close. And that's based on the idea that the Bell correlations we've seen in experiments to date arise from the fact that the definite measurement outcomes, which come from some sort of localized collapse, don't actually take place in the two wings of the experiment, but only take place at a later point when the correlated measurement data are compared and amplified in some appropriate way. So one can like or loathe localized collapse hypotheses, but they're out there, and they're, you know, there are thoughtful and respectable motivations for taking them seriously, given our current state of quantum theory, starting with Wigner's idea of consciousness, and then the more recent and maybe more attractive ideas of gravitationally induced collapse or spontaneous localization. So in words, and I'll translate in diagrams in a minute, the point is that all the standard Bell experiments, including the so-called loophole-free ones, don't produce outcome signals that involve macroscopic superpositions in the two wings, nor, of course, are they consciously observed by humans at space-like separated points in the two wings. These things happen, if at all, only much, much later after the data have been brought together. So, schematically, here's a Bell experiment. We've got a source of entangled photons. It goes to filters and multipliers in the two wings, and then the electronic signals take the data to a coincidence counter, which eventually uses a PRL. So on the hypothesis that we're trying to exclude, if the collapse locality loophole were applying, what we'd be doing is inferring faux non-local correlations from coincidences here, even though, in fact, the collapses actually took place only here or later, maybe even in PRL, and so involved no space-like separation. And if you think of a sort of Bell hidden variables version of this story, the standard assumption is that Bell experiments are refuting the possibility that the hidden variables depend on data available essentially just at the source, or past like kind of the source in the two wings. But one version of the collapse locality loophole would be that you've got a collapse over here, but not here, in which case this outcome can depend on the collapse data, which includes the measurement choice and the measurement outcome through local hidden variable here. Likely a possibility, because the symmetry in these experiments is that collapse takes place neither there nor there. But jointly, these two things both depend on, well, the collapses only take place here, and they take place essentially simultaneously, and they can depend then on both measurement choices, of course. That's enough to reproduce the appearance of verifying quantum theory without excluding open variables. Question?
Bringing together, it's kind of a strong idea, but usually, if it's macroscopically recorded, people say collapse happened. Here, you have this cloning machine, it's still quantum devices, yeah. You can believe it. But in the experiment, the photons are macroscopically recorded. Then they wait a long time, and only later they make this Bell measurement. So,
sorry, in whose experiment? In most Bell experiments, you say.
Hanson, but that's, for me, it's, you know, Harald Weinfurter did essentially the same what Hanson did. So we have these two systems, which, you know, they have some memory of this entanglement. It's created by photons. After it's created, they send signals to measure, so...
So thanks for pressing on this. Yeah, we need to talk about localized collapse hypotheses and what counts as macroscopic amplification. Maybe it's helpful to discuss the one experiment that has tried to address this, to my knowledge, which was Nicolas Gissin's group, led by Salah. So the key question here is, when is a quantum measurement finished, as they say? Quantum theory has no definite answer. This leads to the measurement problem. So what the version of localized collapse that they were trying to take into account is based on Penrose's and Diossi's intuitions that you don't get a collapse until you get a macroscopic superposition of a massive enough system in two different places. I said that in words, but it's quantified, at least in a hand-wavy way. What do you mean by massive enough? What do you mean by separation? Penrose and Diossi give equations for that. So that was tested in this experiment, as I'll describe, but I don't believe it was tested in loophole-free experiments, although I'm happy to go through them with you afterwards. And
I don't know the detail, but there are some counters. They counted, they made some clicks, showed, so clearly, I think it's pretty clearly fulfilled the Penrose condition.
It has to be done in space-like separated regions.
After it happened for the photon pairs, this was then they sent signals, so they will make measurement on their atoms, and these atoms were keeping. So it looks all okay.
I mean,
they didn't bring them together. The information, of course, from two atoms. If you say that we wait until information brought together, but this sounds very strange.
You need to wait until there's a macroscopic condition.
Let's talk afterwards.
On this is the hypothesis that's being tested. I'm not saying this is dogma about the world. This is the hypothesis that's being tested. One among many reasons I don't believe their experiment closed it is that I talked to Hansen and agreed they can close it. But we can go through them paper afterwards. Okay, so what did the Geneva experiment do? Well, they took the results of the photon detector and ran the electronic signal, it's a small pulse, through a very nearby pizza crystal, which has the property that it sort of compresses in one direction and it expands in another. And to be sure that they knew what the thing was doing, they put a mirror on the end of the pizza crystal and they had an interferometry experiment that was sensitive to this displacement so that you can tell whether the crystal has expanded or not by looking at effectively at this distance in the interferometer. So this was there in both wings. There was a crystal in each wing. So what happens? You get a pulse from a photon detector. The crystal responds very fast. I'll say how fast in a minute. The mirror allows you to measure the deformation of the crystal very precisely and also very fast by interferometry. At the separation, 18 kilometers, so about 60 microseconds. And if you run through the numbers, the time from the photons entering the detector to the mirror displacement is about 6 microseconds. The displacement of the mirror is the order of 10 nanometers. The mass of the mirror was order of milligrams. If you put those numbers, those displacement and the mass into Penrose and Diossi's estimates for collapse time based on their intuitions, you should get a collapse within 1 microsecond. So remember, we had 6 microseconds delay between the photon entering the detector and the mirror displacing. So we get a total of about 7 microseconds, and that's at least an order of magnitude, almost an order of magnitude smaller than the separation. So on Penrose and Diossi's intuitions, one has indeed tested this loophole, and quantum theory, you'd have heard about it if it hadn't, quantum theory survives. So that was a really beautiful experiment, to my mind, but it's not an ideal test of the general idea for several reasons, one of which is that there's quite a lot of theoretical uncertainty in these estimates. A couple of powers of 4 pi would make a big difference. So even for the gravitational version of the collapse hypothesis, we need stronger tests. And there are other well-motivated collapse hypotheses out there, spontaneous localization models, or even Wigner's idea, which it would be nice to test. And just as a side comment, I may not be able to say more about it in this talk. Notice that this, one would naturally infer that you're getting non-local correlations with the gravitational field because you're making these mirrors displace or not, depending on the outcome of Bell experiments. But they weren't directly observed. There was nothing measuring the local gravitational field. Okay, so I want to make at least one simple point. There's a very simple way of extending this experiment or other experiments in this direction to give much stronger tests of collapse locality loophole, and it will work for any localized collapse hypothesis you might be interested in, and it would allow us to do it over separations of diameter of the Earth or into space without requiring entanglement on those scales. So let's, this is rather abstract and schematic, but let's run with it. Let's sort of summarize the Salar et al. Experiment. We have the source and the photons. We have detectors here. We have some channel, in this case, electrical signals, that lead to some apparatus, in this case, the pizza crystals. And the hypothesis that's being tested is that collapses, because of the properties of the apparatus, collapses take place within the apparatus here, within the apparatus here, and not in the detectors here and here. If they took place there, we'd already have, it's already been tested in standard Bell experiments, and not in the channels here and here, because the hypothesis is that you need macroscopic superpositions of masses, and these are just electrical signals, and they don't. They're nowhere close to being the right sort of scale. So, and in the Salar et al. Experiment, this green circle that contains all of the above on the left was space-like separated from the green circle on the right that contains all of those things on the right. So you might think that that's not just nice, but essential for testing this version of loophole. But it's not. The hypothesis we're testing is that collapses take place in the apparatus and not before. So not in the detectors, not in the channels. Thanks. So the only space-like separations we need are the regions just around the apparatus during the relevant collapse time. Which means you only need a local Bell experiment, and then some way of sending signals, and it could be by radio waves or fiber optics, whatever you like, or results of those experiments, to distant points where the relevant sort of apparatuses sit in order to test this loophole. So here's a little version of that in which the experiment's somewhere in Africa and the apparatuses at the poles on Earth. And of course, if you want to go out into space, well, you can do that as well. And to test the Wigner version of the loophole, and I guess you're going to want to in the end, your apparatus should include human observers. So you need one astronaut somewhere out in space, but only one. And you don't need to send them entanglement. You only need to send them radio signals. And you need another human somewhere on Earth. I'm really worried about what's happened to the UK and Ireland in Microsoft's image of the globe. I think Brexit has a lot to answer for. But anyway. There were a couple of other things I could have talked about, but I don't want to close off discussion time. So it never works well when people sort of rush through things at the end of talks. So I'm happy to leave it there, and if people want to hear more about these ideas, I'm happy to talk afterwards. Thanks very much.
Questions then? Does anybody want to start?
In this kind of picture here.
Yeah.
Could it even be that the humans are on the opposite side of the Bell experiment, the side of the influence. Could that red line be rotated so it's down?
Yeah.
trying to understand.
I'm not sure I understand. You mean this arrow could go here and this one here?
Imagine.
The only condition is that they have to be separated. It doesn't matter.
Yeah,
they get a signal from the closer or the further side of the experiment.
Yeah, as long as your collapse hypothesis is telling you there shouldn't have been collapses.
Yeah, that's weird.
So regarding your devices, they remind me a little bit of surrealistic trajectories.
Okay.
So far as if I were to follow up that device on the right there, which you're on the board, with the measurement in the basis to which it's being collapsed, it would of course tell you that you would get a definite outcome. So there's a sense in which you could have operational evidence for the state prior to that measurement not being a complete mixed state, even though your readout device assigns the complete mixed state. Like, so suppose we did this many times, and I have my device.
Yeah.
I post-select on the cases where on the left you found it was in state 0.
Yeah.
So in all those experiments, my device on the right is saying, yes, it was in the state 1. And yet the readout is still saying, it's a half-byte identity.
Well, the readout... Remember, the readout device says it's half identity up to this point, and then it changes its mind and says it's state one after all.
It says it's a half identity even in the sub collection of cases where I got always the same outcome on the left. Did you agree?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's disagreeing with the operational outcomes that I'm registering on the right hand side. It's
and it's disagreeing with itself later in time, indeed.
Sure.
Yeah.
This was exactly my question. If you make macroscopic amplification, make this tomography of all these things, and then you're supposed to get this eye, and this is kind of inconsistent with... seems.
I'm not seeing an inconsistency. I've got one claim of inconsistency, but is... Are you claiming inconsistency, or are you claiming...
I guess I'm claiming that... I don't think I'm claiming inconsistency, but you might have thought, given that you called it the local quantum state, that it would feature in a particular way in certain operational calculations of what would occur if I were to do a measurement in that case. But you would be radically mistaken to interpret a local quantum state in that way, because that description, a half identity, does not help me make operational predictions. Whereas if instead I used standard operational theory and said, how should I update my description of the quantum state of system B, given that I observe 0 here, I would make much better predictions than using a half identity. So in that sense, it's just maybe a complaint about the term local quantum state, but also just much like the discussion around surrealistic trajectories, where people were assigning realities that had nothing to do with the outcomes that were observed, like in these Bohmian experiments. It seems to me like you're assigning descriptions of a quantum state system that have nothing to do with the outcomes of experiments I would do in that quantum system.
Well, so what to say to that? The model itself would say no. If you have these black boxes, this is an experiment you could do, and here's the answer we give, and the model predicts it. It's true you could do different experiments, and they will give different answers. And if you're going to run with, and this may be a reason why you don't want it, but if you're going to run with hybrid classical quantum, classical gravity quantum matter hypotheses, you should at least accept the possibility that there's going to be some discrepancy between what you get when you probe something with the classical degrees of freedom and what you get when you probe it with quantum degrees of freedom. So I know semi-classical gravity is wrong and problematic for other reasons, but for instance, you see that very strongly in semi-classical gravity. So I agree you might say it's an unaesthetic feature in this whole line of thought, both in the model and in classical quantum hybrids. But it's definitely a feature that what's experimentally obtainable, the answer to what you can extract from experiment depends on how you're probing the thing. And there's more than one answer, and they don't necessarily agree.
Can you clarify? Maybe I misunderstood. What I understood is that after you measured 0 there, then you claim that here there is a density matrix I until later. And this is kind of feasible if you're talking about this black box with two quantum states. But now I add a tomography at that time of my two spins.
Okay.
So if you say that there is this mixed state, I will see this mixed state.
No.
Or you say that if I will add tomography, it will break down.
If you do tomography and it causes a collapse, then of course it will change the state here, and it will change what the black box says after you've done the tomography.
But I make it an ensemble. So you, tomography.
Well, you do it state by state. But,
then I make post-selection. Every time I will look on zero here and slightly epsilon time later, I make this strong measurement of my black box with two spins. And then I make analysis of a large ensemble. So what is the meaning, what you are saying? I think the meaning is that my tomography should tell me, never mind what's there, this, you believe that this is a state. No?
No.
So what does it mean, a state? It's state if you don't measure it?
No.
If you measure it, it will be different? What is the meaning? Well, what is the meaning? Then what is the operational meaning of this?
You've got to play the game the right way, Lev. What's the meaning of the output of a PR box? It's what you would get in a hypothetical model in which quantum theory was extended by these hypothetical devices.
To bring me these boxes.
Yeah.
Because the idea of boxes is that they work properly if somebody will bring them up.
Yeah, if PR boxes actually exist, then same story here. What's the meaning of the output of these boxes? Well, in a hypothetical world in which they're feasible, it's what the boxes would output, and it gives you physical possibilities that weren't available to you without the boxes. Like the model, hate the model, that's your choice, or anything that follows from it. As with PR boxes.
I'm a little confused about like what Robert said, because it seems entirely consistent to me that until you actually know that A had an outcome zero, like you would not do the update to like one on the other side, right? And that only happens later. Before that, your local descriptions will match. Is that what you were saying?
No, I think if I was a quantum physicist who believed operational quantum theory, and I was asked to predict the outcome of a measurement of the 0-1 basis, just space-like separated by from my local measurement of the 0-1 basis, here's how I would use the formalism. You know, I update the quantum state of the distance system, not only at the later time when light has time, but even prior to that distance space-like separated measurement, which allows me to predict that thing's going to have a definite outcome. And so this readout device is not reading out the quantum state that, as an operational quantum physicist, I would assign prior to that measurement device. It's reading out something else, which now you tell me is the thing that classical degrees of freedom respond to, whereas quantum measurement devices respond to the thing that we as operational quantum physicists usually write down. That's kind of it.
Yeah. So what would A say? A would say if B carry out her own measurement, if B carries out a quantum measurement, B will get the answer one. A would also say if B puts the thing into their readout device, B will get the answer half I until this point, and then the answer one.
I think we should close the discussion here because it's coffee break time. So let's thank Adrian, and we're coming back here on floor for discussion.